Stu Does America.
Well, we have a State of the Union coming up next week on Tuesday. I will be here on Blaze TV talking to you about it, watching it along with you. I would encourage you to join us. It's blazetv.com/Stu. Promo code is Stu. We will also be doing a pre-show. Now, the pre-show is going to be a little bit different, not just talking about what's coming up in the speech per se, but also going through the prediction markets as they are related to the speech. They have these things called mention markets. What words is, you know, what's Trump really going to be talking about? What specific words is he going to say during the speech? It's a lot of fun. It's the most fun you'll ever have watching a speech, that I promise you. We're going to preview all of that before the show. We'll give you the details on that. It's going to be Tuesday as well. If you want like those details, go to predictableshow.com. Predictableshow.com. We're going to be starting that show up in a few weeks, and we're getting that all that started kind of behind the scenes right now. You should subscribe to YouTube as well. You can see that show, Predictable Show, will eventually be on YouTube as well, youtube.com/Stu Does America. Lauren Fix is here to help me personally put an end to the stop-start feature in cars, because I hate it more than anything in the world. I've got some nerding out to do over trade deficits. You don't want to miss that. Maybe you do. I mean, if I'm being perfectly honest, maybe you do want to miss it because it's going to be very nerdy. But we're going to do it anyway. And we're going to start by doing self-hating Democrats, because that's a lot more fun than trade deficits. You've noticed this, right? Like, I don't know. It seems like there is a little bit of trouble in paradise these days over on the Democratic side. You've seen some of these divides before. John Fetterman slamming anti-Israel rot in Democratic Party, rejects AOC's claims of Gaza genocide. Then you've got a House Democrat, that is Moskowitz. He's fighting with Mamdani because Mamdani wants a wealth tax, and Moskowitz says that's not going to work. By the way, one reason it's not going to work as a federal situation is because it's completely unconstitutional. Thought you might want to know that. Now, of course, Mamdani does not care whatsoever about those sort of things. Bernie Sanders and Gavin Newsom are fighting. They're adversaries over the push to tax California billionaires. Of course, you know, Bernie Sanders, number one, is a socialist. Number two, doesn't have to worry about actually funding the state and, you know, building new magical railroads across it. So he doesn't care about whether all the billionaires leave or not. He's going to get their money either way, right? He's federal. But Gavin does, at some level at least. He's doing a terrible job, as we discussed in depth yesterday. But that's the way this works. And it's not just sort of these anecdotal situations where you're looking at that and you're saying, wow, these guys seem to be kind of at odds. There's a lot of, there's a big divide inside that party. Now, that's not to say, I will point out that there's none of this going on the right. It is existing on the right as well, but on the left, it's really interesting because you think you'd be at a place, usually what happens is, you know, one party wins and the other side kind of like unites together. They push back, they win, then they divide, the other side wins. Like, it kind of goes back and forth. This should be the time where Democrats are kind of together. Right. They're uniting. They're saying, gosh, this evil orange guy, Donald Trump, he's really bad. We don't like him. And we're all going to unite to overthrow that. You saw some of that, I think, during 2024, where people looked at the Biden situation and were like, gosh, we don't want any more of this. They united around Trump, even though there was a lot of people who liked him and a lot of people who didn't like him on the Republican side. They came together to make sure he had four more years because we didn't want four more years of that. And certainly not four more years of Kamala Harris. But the polling is showing this as well. There's real consternation among Democrats about Democrats. Many Democrats are still down on the Democratic Party. A new APNORC poll finds. Let me give you some charts. It's Chartapalooza here on Stu Does America, because that's what we do here. Many Democrats still down on their party after 2024. You see, there was some uniting going on, a little bit maybe you could argue, in the early days of the Trump administration, where approval of the Democratic Party among Democrats rose north of 83%. Now it's dropped to 70. Interesting. Not a massive drop off, but significant. You want your party going into an election united, excited, passionate, able to get everybody out to the polls. You want that to be going on, or you could be having some problems. Positive views of the Democratic Party are down among Democrats from 92% back at the turn of the century, and basically stayed about even, you know, some drop-offs into the high 80s occasionally. We've never seen one as low as it is now, though. 80% approval rating among Democrats of Democrats. kind of interesting. Now, if you, of course, look at the positive views of Democrats among Republicans, you can assume that would be very, very low, and it is 5%. The 22% number at the beginning of this, probably a little high just based on the aftermath of September 11th, because that actually got up over 30% after September 11th, but has been, you know, typically in the mid-teens or so, dropping down to 5%. If you look at independents, you get a number that started about 50% and is now down to 31% over that time. That's not good. That's bad. Negative views of dominate for Democrats and GOP. Percent of U.S. adults with an unfavorable view of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Well, no one likes either of them. That's kind of the story here. Now, if you get the narrative here, which was around the Iraq War, you saw a separation where people had more negative views of the Republican Party. That evened out in the middle of Barack Obama's first term and around the Tea Party era, where actually more people viewed the Democrats negatively for a short time. That reversed around and certainly held through the Trump era in the first term, and actually reversed again during the Biden administration. But right now, it's pretty close. 61% view the Democratic Party unfavorably. That is up. And 58% the Republican Party negatively. Now, one of the things that always happens is I keep getting these clips sent to me of Harry Enten. Harry Enten's a guy on CNN. He was at 538 before this. I really like Harry Enten. You don't get a sense of his politics when he's giving you data, which is something I really appreciate. And so you don't see that a lot, certainly in the media. So he'll give you some positive things about Democrats, give you some negative things about Democrats. And everyone sends me the clips all the time of him on CNN because no one can believe this actually occurs on CNN, which it does occasionally. It does, especially on Harry's segments. Here is Harry's segment, Harry Enten talking to one of the individuals who has or was filling in for a show on CNN, I think.
CNN's Harry Enten is running the numbers on this in a specific way, how one party you see in the numbers is facing more pressure than the others, and that's the Democrats. Why?
Why is it that the Democrats, in my mind, are facing more pressure, those Democratic leaders? And that is because their base thinks that their party leaders are weak, weak, weak. Look at this. Democrats on who has strong leaders. Look at this. 54%. Say neither party, 54% of Democrats say neither party has strong leaders. Among Republicans, 80% of their base thinks Republicans have strong leaders. Yet among Democrats, just get this, just 35% of Democrats say their party has strong leaders. When you add together this 54% with this 11%, we're talking about two-thirds of Democrats who say neither party or Republicans have stronger leaders, as compared to just 35% who say their own parties have strong leaders. As I said at the top, weak, weak, weak is how Democrats view their leaders in Washington.
That's not good if you're a Democrat. By the way, obviously, as I was saying, that was Kate Baldwin with Harry Enten. Kate Baldwin, someone I'm very familiar with, as she hosts her daily or weekly program or monthly. Annual. It could be an annual program. Okay, here's more with Harry Enten.
And this is the other thing. It's not just that Democrats think that their party leaders are weak, weak, weak. They also think they don't get anything done. I mean, take a look here. Okay, Democrats and who get things done. Again, it's just 50% of Democrats say neither party gets anything done. Just 41% of Democrats say their own party gets stuff done. When you add in this 9% of Democrats who say the Republican Party is more likely to get things done with neither party, we're talking about 3 in 5 Democrats who say neither party or Republicans are more likely to get things done than the Democratic Party. And again, that is the complete inverse of how Republicans feel, because 77% of Republicans think their own party leaders are likely to get things done, compared to just 41% of Democrats, about half that level, who think their own leaders get things done. Again, Democrats just don't think very highly of their party at this point, and that is why there's so much pressure on those leaders, in my mind, in Washington, to actually do something that satisfies their base.
Not great. Now, one thing I always stress with you when we talk polls is that polls are really good at telling you generalities. They're not surgical instruments most of the time. They don't. They when you're like, hey, one candidate's supposed to win 49-48, and then the other candidate wins, you're like, oh, the polls are wrong. Not really, honestly. Like, the polls, what we want from the polls are not what the polls do. It's like the most fundamentally important thing to understand. What we want from the polls is who's going to win, who's going to lose. That's all we want. What polls do is give you a general tone of what the race looks like. That's what they do. So when you have something like a 49-48 race, the fact that the other candidate wins 49-48 is actually the poll doing a pretty good job at what it's attempting to do. I know that's it pisses everybody off, but it's just the reality of the situation. When you kind of see them in that view, you say, oh, wow, well, actually they're very useful instruments. They're not perfect, but they're useful instruments. A poll like that is an interesting one as well because, you know, the 9% number of people who think Democrats don't get anything done, but Republicans do out of the Democrat population is an interesting one because I think, to be fair, you'd look at your party and say, we're having problems getting things done. Republicans, you'd have to say, even if you didn't like the things they were doing, you'd have to admit they were getting things done. Trump is like, he's got 5,000 things every day he's doing. I don't even know how he keeps up with it, honestly. He's an Energizer bunny when it comes to, at least executive orders. Now, legislation, not quite as much. One big, beautiful bill, and that's been pretty much it. But certainly a lot of stuff is getting done. And it's like, if he wasn't getting anything done, you probably wouldn't hate him as much as you do. That's just the way those things work. Okay, a couple more here from Harry Enten and Kate Baldwin.
Add all of this up, what does it say about the view of the Democratic Party in general?
Yeah, if you think your party has weak leaders, if you think your party can't get anything done, well, this is, I think, the real pressure facing Democrats at this particular point. Democrats who think their parties need major changes or more, look at this, 57% of Democrats say their party needs major changes or more compared to just 43% who say minor or no changes. Again, very different than the Republican Party, where 21% of Republicans, only 21% say their party needs major changes or more. Again, a lot of pressure on Democratic leaders to actually do something their base likes for a change.
All right, so you get the point here. The Democrats don't really like the Democrats all that much, and this is showing up in weird ways. Let me give you a couple views into the primary season. We're just sort of starting that right now. We're starting to look at that situation, I think. The Texas one is, what, early March, I think? I'm pretty sure. I don't have the date in front of me, but it's early March, if I remember correctly. And James Tallarico is one of the guys who is running for the Democratic Senate. This is a man trying to stop Jasmine Crockett from being in our lives. I want you to know, a white man is trying to do that. Okay? This white man wants several more months of Jasmine Crockett in our lives. I've got a cutoff about late October, okay? But I want her absolutely in our lives more. And actually, once the election's over, I'd like her to run for some president of the United States. That's what I want her to run for. Immediately jump into the race for president. That's what I want. Then I want her to win the nomination. And then I want her to be in our lives again until October 2028-ish. I'll give you that scenario a little bit later, but Tallarico is getting a burst of momentum from a CBS controversy. And when we say CBS controversy, what we mean here is a coordinated lie between a candidate and the host of a CBS show. That is exactly what happened. If you didn't follow this, it's absolutely amazing. Basically, he goes on the Colbert show or whatever it's called now. And again, why would James Tallarico? I mean, you guys are obsessed with politics. I know that, okay? I know you watch the show all the time. And when you're watching the show, you're obsessed with politics. You watch The Blaze. You watch the Glenn Beck program. You're doing all the things that tie you very closely into politics. If you're not in Texas, have you heard the name James Tallarico? Why on earth would Colbert's audience have any interest in this man whatsoever? And of course, the truth of the matter there is they don't. So he came on, they booked him for an interview, inexplicably. He does the interview and he gets word from the lawyers that say, hey, by the way, if we're putting Tallarico on this close to a primary, we probably also have to put on our girl, Jasmine Crockett. You can't just, you know, and there's also, I think there's only those two, right? Maybe there's another one in there too, I can't remember. But those are the two main candidates. You got to put the other one on. That would be a violation of, you know, stupid election laws that I don't agree with, but liberals like. So he gets that word. He then decides to just put the thing online, not put it on the show. Now, this is actually, in a way, a brilliant programming decision because nobody cares about James Tallarico. His audience does not care about this at all. But it also does what he wants to accomplish when it comes to trying to get him to win the primary. Now, he wants Tallarico to win the primary because, of course, some people say Jasmine Crockett has absolutely no chance of winning statewide in Texas, and that's why people like me want her to win. Now, that's not true, of course. I just love her. But that's what people accuse me of. That being said, they blame the Trump administration and the Trump FCC for coming in and saying, you can't run that interview. This is not what happened at all. By the way, that was confirmed by CBS later on, who came out and said, yeah, that's not true at all. Here is Tallarico and the whole story going on right now. This is also a clip from Harry Enten. What was the outcome of all of this fake controversy? Worked very well for James.
What about the prediction market? What do we see? Chance to be the Texas Democratic Senate nominee. Look at this. On Sunday, Tallarico was the favorite, but it was pretty close, a 61% chance. But look at that. It turns out this attention was very good for Tallarico, the prediction market, Kelsey prediction market, having his chance go all the way up to 3-4 at this point, a 75% chance of winning that nomination.
Ah, would you look at that? And he didn't have to tank one of his segments with terrible ratings having James Tallarico on. So it really did work well for Colbert, and obviously he has zero ability to tell, speak something truthful. So it kind of fit into the show format. But CBS did throw a curveball in the Tallarico Crockett race. Another sign of his rising profile, Google Trends data, which grades interest on a 100-point scale, found interest in Tallarico jumped from about 2 points in the past week to 100 points. Tuesday evening, Crockett's interest hit a week-long high at about 20 points. So again, this did the job. This is what they wanted to do. Here's what Polymarket looks like on that particular race. By the way, you see the same jump that you saw over at Kalshi. A jump back up to, these are the levels of maybe 6 months ago, or actually a few months ago, February, sorry, I'm misreading the chart. February is where kind of Tallarico looked like he was leading. Jasmine got some momentum, I assume, from us, because we love her so much. Anyway, she's down now at 20%. Other way, just to kind of keep you up to date on the Texas race briefly, what the Democrats believe, And I don't know if this is true or not, but what Democrats believe is their best chance to actually win a Senate race in Texas is to have James Tallarico, the boring white bread guy that nobody knows and, really is a complete bore and just cringy, instead of Crockett, and to have Paxton win the primary instead of Cornyn or Hunt. The other two candidates on the Republican side. Cornyn, of course, is a very long-term senator and not a good one, frankly, from the state of Texas. The Texas Senate race, Ken Paxton leads Cornyn. New primary poll ahead of early voting. 36% for Paxton, 27% for Cornyn, 15% for Wesley Hunt, 22% undecided. How does that work out in the prediction markets? Polymarket shows it this way. A big lead for Ken Paxton at 76%. John Cornyn at 20%, Wesley Hunt at 3.5%. Now, I would favor Ken Paxton in this race. 76% seems really high. The reason is because what we're going to have here is a situation that is undoubtedly going to go to runoff. So they'll have the primary, it will go to a runoff, and then you'll have some time where Cornyn versus likely Cornyn, it could be Hunt, but likely Cornyn versus Paxton is the primary. They go in, and usually what happens in those situations is hardcore conservatives come out for the primary or for the runoff. And in that situation, Paxton is expected to win. So that's why he's at 76%. Though, Cornyn definitely, he's got way more money and way more help around the country from Republicans. We'll see if that's enough. By the way, Polymarket shows that it is a 67% chance for the Republican to win no matter what the outcome is. Again, heavily favoring Tallarico, heavily favoring Paxton. That's the way Democrats wanted it to go. If it does go that way, still, you got a 2/3 chance that the Republicans win, according to the markets. And again, if you disagree with that, you can always just go make money. PredictableShow.com. Have I mentioned that recently? PredictableShow.com. Go there. We'll help you. We'll help you make money. We'll try to help you make money. And we'll, complain if the results are bad anyway. We'll be sad about the results, but hopefully wealthier regardless of what happens either way. Another race that's a fascinating one is the race in Maine. Now, you have the situation where you have an establishment person, governor, popular in the state, Janet Mills, going up against Nazi tattoo-wearing Graham Plattner. You'll be surprised to hear, once again, this divide in the Democratic Party is playing out. Janet Mills is flopping in the fight for Maine Senate. This is not exactly, a pro-Mills view here, but they're talking about donors. The quarterly report shows Plattner with 2,119 donations below $150 this quarter. Governor Mills had 1,075. I mean, this is a little bit of a reach to say she's flopping, but the polls show it and the prediction markets show it as well. If you look at Polymarket, 64% chance for Graham Plattner to win that primary. That is, you want to talk about, Susan Collins' dream situation is being able to go against Graham Plattner in this race instead of Janet Mills. She's only at 34%. Finally, I'll give you one more. In California, this is one of the things, like, for a while, Republicans would just, like, pick really bad candidates and they would lose. Like, we do that all the time, honestly. The Democrats are getting into that vibe right now. Right now, they're thinking about picking Eric Swalwell to be the gubernatorial candidate and to, I guess, replace Gavin Newsom. Fascinating. Really fascinating. And let me give you the, because, it's sometimes just fun to see the misery of others. It's not maybe our best instinct, but sometimes we really feel good when we get to look at the other people that we maybe don't love all that much having misery in their lives. Now, this is soft misery, but let me show you this poll. It is from California. Now, the way the California race runs for governor is called a jungle primary. Basically, everybody runs, no matter what party you're in a massive primary. And out of that primary, you can keep the poll on the screen, two candidates come out of that primary, okay? The top two, then they go into a runoff. What typically happens is either two Democrats come out of it, or one Republican and one Democrat come out of it. And of course, in California, the Democrat always wins. Very bizarre situation here in that two of the top three candidates in this race are Republicans. You have Hilton, who's the guy you've probably seen on Fox News a million times. He's actually leading right now at 17%. In second place, tied for second place, is Eric Swalwell, the Democrat, at 14%. And Chad Bianco, who's a law enforcement guy, at 14%. Behind that, you have Katie Porter, who's had all sorts of scandals, as well as Swalwell has as well, at 10%. Tom Steyer, the billionaire who spent a bunch of his money to lose a previous presidential race, going to try the same thing here in California. He's at 9%. He is rising, though. He's spending tons of money. You have Becerra, you have Villarosa there. All these people are familiar Democratic names. Now, you do have 21% undecided. Most likely, that 21% will spread out among Democrats and wind up at least getting one Democrat into that final round, if not both. But there's the slightest of chances that this winds up being a runoff between Hilton, the Republican, and Bianco, the Republican, which would just be hilarious. I would love that. By the way, California on Polymarket, the California gubernatorial election winner, they don't believe that's going to happen. Have Eric Swalwell as a relatively heavy favorite. In second place, Matt Mahan. In third place, Steve Hilton. And then fourth, Katie Porter. Then you have Bianco, who's the other Republican, as a possibility right now. We will see how that one plays out as well. Lots of really intricate election stuff coming out. We've got the primary season. Then we will go into, of course, election mode. All of that, by the way, great place to go, predictableshow.com. You might say, well, I don't care about prediction markets. We're going to be going through all the data to kind of show you the best possible coverage of the election, and we'll be doing that at predictableshow.com. Just go there, just your email, it's free, and we will keep you updated on everything that's coming forward. And if you are looking as well to maybe, I don't know, pay a couple bills, maybe pay for a vacation or two, something nice, you can go there as well. And we will do our very, very best to look for markets where there are opportunities. Not a financial advice show, but it's, we can look for opportunities to hopefully do pretty well in this upcoming election season. Even if catastrophic things happen to our country, maybe you'll be slightly wealthier so they can take that money through taxes. It's going to be lots of fun. All right, let's talk about cars, because this has been a great week, and I've been trying to highlight this almost every day. This week, the great job the president has done when it comes to the environment. Lee Zeldin as well. The administration's done a great job when it comes to this. And it's going to affect the way you're driving in the future. We'll get to that with Lauren Fix next. Joined once again by Lauren Fix, automotive expert and host of The Drive with Lauren and Carl. Her newest piece for The Blaze is out right now. It is taxpayers paid $8 million for electric buses that can't run in the cold in Vermont. What a surprise that is. Be sure to check that one out. Lauren, thanks so much for coming back on the program.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I was shocked to find the total was $8 million was spent on six buses. Now, if you divide that out, that's kind of a waste of money because you could buy probably four or five buses for each $1 million that were spent. So instead, this Burlington, Vermont decided to waste your taxpayer dollars again.
Yeah, let's go through this because honestly, you could buy a million buses. If none of them run, it doesn't really help you at all. It just winds up being a big rolling paperweight. I know that there... that electric cars do struggle in extreme temperatures, right? Like when we say they're not running in Vermont, what are we talking about here?
Well, they're supposed to have a range of 258 miles. For public city buses, that's absurd because that's not enough when considering they're taking people to work. They're trying to get people on public transportation. And when public transportation isn't functioning properly and only has a range of 258 miles, that's when all conditions are perfect. That's a problem. So those buses are now parked outside the building in Burlington, Vermont. And this is not just Burlington, by the way. This is across the entire upper half of the country. That includes Buffalo, New York, Chicago, you name it, just take the upper half of the country. And so because of potential fire hazards and all this, leaving them on the charger for long periods of time because of the cold weather and the slow charge, because it means a slow charge as well as shortened range, these vehicles sit outside. So they charge even slower and they don't use them. So instead, all these cities across the upper half of the country went back to diesel buses, which go hundreds of miles on a full tank. And you can fill up a full tank at your filling station in minutes rather than hours and hours and hours.
It's amazing because the other part about this too, Lauren, is, and I don't know if this is different with the buses, but I know like people who own electric cars know that every manual tells you don't charge it to full capacity. So they say, hey, it goes to 250 miles, but don't ever do that because if you do that, it's going to wear down the battery. You can do it if you're going on a long trip or something, but generally speaking, they advise you not to do that regularly. With a bus that's going around a city, you know, that doesn't work. If it's just a car at home, you're commuting to work, it's fine to go to 80% most days. When you're talking about a bus that needs to kind of keep going all day long, that's a disaster, isn't it?
It's an absolute disaster. People aren't getting to work. And when they get on the bus, there's no heat because that takes up energy, which is battery power. So then they find themselves in a situation where we don't have the heat on. So people are getting on the bus with children, disabled people, people that, you know, need to older people. You want to keep them warm and you can't. Because they can't run the heaters because it shortens the distance even more. So on a car, you're going to lose about a third of your range. So whether it's a Tesla or you name the brand, it's going to lose range because the batteries don't like to work in extreme heat, which would be like Arizona and so forth, or extreme cold, which is Burlington, Vermont. And because of that, it even shortens the range even more. And the bus drivers get frustrated. People that ride them get frustrated. Buses don't arrive when they're supposed to, and you don't get to where you need to be.
Riding a bus is already a miserable experience. As I remember Weird Al telling us many, many years ago, and he was very much right when he sang Another One Rides the Bus. I won't sing the whole lyrics for you here, Lauren, but I think you know I'm right on that one. Let me go to a different topic, and this has been like the bane of my existence for a very long time. We've talked a lot about the endangerment finding. This is something that went through, and the Obama administration said basically, hey, you know, the whole global warming thing, that's real. CO2 is affecting your life, and that way we can regulate every part of your life. That has been luckily pulled down by the Trump administration, pending many, many legal challenges, of course. But a great, great thing that Zeldin and the EPA and, of course, the Trump administration was able to accomplish. So all that is background to part of this is the start-stop feature of your car. If you've ever pulled up to a stop sign and as you stop the car, your car turns off And then when you start accelerating again, it turns back on. You know how annoying that feature is. This is just mercifully going away, isn't it, Lauren?
Yes, this is fantastic news. Credit to Lee Zeldin, because he was on this from day one. Now, the endangerment finding is a very interesting situation. And when they started talking about removing the greenhouse gases, I actually spoke in front of Congress, which was my first time and an interesting experience, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Of course, everyone that they had on speaking was for leaving it the way it was. And I was probably one of the few people speaking against it. But the reason that it made sense is the Chevron deference, which was removed under the Supreme Court, saying that because the rules say what they do, that's what the rules are. So under these unelected bureaucrats, they were expanding it to what the rules didn't say. And that meant mandating electric vehicles, controlling the start-stop technology that they mandated on the manufacturers, all these things that Lee Zeldin has removed forever. And this is not like the Congressional Review Act, where they took the powers away from California, stopped the mandate. This is permanent. This is saying that if you want to change the rules, it has to go through Congress. You can't just make the rules up as you wish because the rules didn't say that. You have to go with what the rules did say. And that's what the Supreme Court put into place. And that's why it took so long for this to become the actual rules. I know that Glenn Beck did something on this too, and he had Lee Zeldin on. It was very interesting. And what I learned that I didn't know when I first worked with Lee Zeldin trying to get the push through my side of it, which is the same as yours, stop the start-stop technology, that's a bonus of removing all of this, in addition to no longer giving car manufacturers, which we all knew about, that free little 1 mile per gallon for the corporate average fuel economy, because they were being fined for not meeting certain fuel economy standards. And under Obama, he wanted it 52 miles a gallon. Car manufacturers can't produce that. They never got above 30. And the only car manufacturer that made that was Honda. The rest of them couldn't make it because they make trucks. So if you average out everything you sell, it's not going to work. Of course, the supercar manufacturers were never going to make it. And they calculated that cost into the cost of cars. And it also made cars very boring looking. They all had to be aerodynamic, lightweight, not necessarily about safety, but about making them all look the same, like a Lada if you lived in Russia.
Yeah, yes, a classic. You know, it's funny, yeah. Lauren, because You mentioned that number real quick, 1 mile per gallon, and it sounds like it's just a number you're throwing out, though. But that's not.
No.
That's the actual estimate of if everything worked with the start-stop feature, that was the sell of it. It would save 1 mile per gallon, which to me, to frustrate every car owner in America, doesn't exactly seem
worth it. Right. I don't care where you stand politically. People do not like, universally, do not like start-stop technology. And in reality, you're saving about a tablespoon of fuel. So when this came out, my first job, because I work with all the car brands, is I sent an email out to every single car brand you can think of that's here in North America. And know what they all said? We'll look into it. None of them said, we'll remove it as soon as possible. We'll offer a software update. We'll help people get rid of it. No, they left it in place. I'm not sure if they think the next administration is going to put it back into place, but I'm going to continue to pressure every single car brand as I see them in person, talk to executives personally. I'm going to email them. I'm going to drive them crazy. Say, you got to remove this and allow people to remove it off of older cars. I mean, I don't have it on my car. I'm driving a 2016, but I have tons of friends, and it's the first complaint they have. Either there's no way to shut it off, or I have to start the car and shut it off.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's comical. My wife has a giant gas guzzling SUV that is completely inefficient, but it has this stupid feature on it, and you have to. It automatically turns on every time you turn on the car, so you have to physically do it, and it's just so annoying. I swear, Lauren, this goes back to the old days. I swear that one of the reasons why people hate this so much is because they're used to that horror, that the feeling of horror when you come to a stop sign and your car would stall. I remember this when I was younger. I had older cars, and like that meant I was, oh no, I'm blocking the road. My car just died. Right. It sends you back to that moment. Nobody likes that moment. It's terrible. And the car manufacturers are like, well, 1 mile per gallon. Let's put everybody through that horror show every day.
But there's more to this, and this is what no one's talking about. There's a safety factor that's involved. So you're at an intersection, you're waiting to make a left turn, and somebody runs a light, or somebody's coming at you, and you're like, oh my gosh, your natural reaction, obviously, is to hit the gas to avoid the situation. That 2 second delay, even 1 second delay, is the difference from being a part of an accident or not. Mm. And that 1 second should be of a concern to the Department of Transportation, NHTSA, and everybody else saying, hold on, there's a safety factor involved. And I don't want to put people at risk when they're trying to reduce traffic accidents. And think about all these autonomous cars. Do they have that too? I don't want to be in a car that has a 2 or 3 second delay while it waits to start back up. And all my safety features aren't working. My air conditioning's not working. My heater's not working. That's absurd. People hate it. Like I said, I don't care where you stand on the political spectrum. People don't like it. And manufacturers need to offer software change, or some company is going to make a lot of money saying, plug this into your onboard diagnostics underneath and we can remove it. And it costs $100.
Oh,
I'd pay that.
I'd pay that in a second to do
me
that.
Too.
Let me
make a lot of money.
Yeah, you really would. One other thing about this stop start situation before I let you go. You wrote a piece about this. One of the things I was told my entire life was the most damaging thing you can do to your engine is turning it off and turning it back on, turning it off and turning it back
Correct.
On. Like, that's what I was always told. Now, my understanding is they have improved that a little bit, but you talked to ASE master technician Greg Damon. I want to read this quote real quick. This is about the start-stop feature. Mechanically, it's a disaster waiting to happen. Constant restarts accelerate wear on starter motors, even reinforced ones. Batteries cycle harder and require more expensive replacements. Engine components face repeated stress, especially during warm restarts when lubrication isn't instantaneous. In shops, mechanics see higher failure rates, specialized repairs, and higher bills. All of that complexity and cost to chase a single mile per gallon on a spreadsheet. I mean, you can't lay it out better than that. This is not only bad for your safety, bad for your sanity, but also terrible for your car.
Right, but you pay the bill. It's not like you're going to go to the car manufacturer and go, hey, you know that start-stop you put in my car cost me, you know, $3,000 in repairs. And personally, I have a vehicle that did have a problem that they call them cam phasers. I won't get technical. But what they failed because of start-stop technology, and I found a way to bypass it in that particular vehicle, because it actually caused engine damage. And I got stuck with the bill. It was $7,500. And I'm like, well, hold on. This should go back to the car brand. And instead of them paying the bill, they basically said, that's on you. So how does that help anyone? So you save a mile of a gallon, but you end up with a bill for a battery, a starter, you know, an engine damage. Who pays that? You do.
Mm-hmm. Every single time. Lauren Fix, automotive expert, host of The Drive with Lauren and Carl. Head over to The Blaze and check out her new piece. It's Taxpayers Paid $8 million for Electric Buses That Can't Run in the Cold in Vermont. Also about the start-stop, it starts stop stiffed. EPA kills annoying automatic engine shutoff. Thank God. Thank you, Lee Zeldin, for being inspired by God to stop that feature. Lauren, we appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks.
We're getting our first official data since all the tariffs have come on board, and it's pretty interesting. U.S. imports grew in 2025 as Trump tariffs reshuffled global trade. We definitely saw a reshuffling going on. You think of tariffs as a, what are you trying to do with them? And there's specific things you're attempting to do. Let's go through some of them. Monthly imports, your idea, of course, would be to try to import fewer items. And you want to build the things in your country, use the things in your country. If you look at monthly imports, unfortunately, though, they are going up at almost their highest level. The only time that they were higher in our history were the few months leading up to the tariffs when people were importing lots of things to predate the tariffs. So, you know, you see, okay, hey, prices are going up next month. Everyone tried to rush a bunch of inventory in, so it spiked there. But other than that, it's never been higher in recent history. Then you have the U.S. trade balance. Now, this is a big thing that Donald Trump cares about quite a bit. He talks about the trade balance. Again, it is going up. Now, I will say, it does. If you look at it, it's not as high as it's ever been. As same thing, the pre-surge. The surge in the pre-tariff period being the higher period, it's towards the middle to the higher point of where it's been. What's fascinating about this, though, is this is a measure, what you're looking at here in Chartapalooza, or if you're listening on podcast, a chart that shows, you know, a relatively high trade deficit. This is, however, goods and services. There's a split between goods and services, a really fascinating one, honestly, because we put no tariffs on services at all. There's no additional, you know, Liberation Day had nothing to do with services. It only had to do with goods. So what do just goods look like? Well, we have that breakdown, and it is bizarre, frankly. Here it is. It is showing that our trade deficit is at the highest point since at least the 90s. when it comes to a deficit in goods. Now, one of the reasons why the trade deficit does not look horrible when it comes to overall is because the services the situation, we have a major surplus. So we wanted to get a surplus in goods. We put tariffs on the goods to get that surplus. Instead, what we got is a bigger deficit. And we didn't put any additional tariffs on services. And what we got out of that is a major surplus. By the way, add on to that, we actually have lost manufacturing jobs. So what we have so far is a higher trade deficit, which, by the way, I should point out, and I may mention this a million times, I don't care about having a higher trade deficit. That's not a statistic that I think matters. What we usually see is a higher trade deficit when the economy is good. And that may be very well a reflection on Donald Trump's other policies when it comes to the economy. The economy is strengthening in certain areas, certainly when it comes to AI. So you're showing strength there. What usually happens when you have strength in your economy is a trade deficit when you're in the United States of America. But we're getting a higher trade deficit, which is the opposite of what we were told we were going to get. We're getting more imports, not less. We're getting fewer manufacturing jobs. We've lost manufacturing jobs month after month after month after month. And the job gains we've got have been healthcare jobs, the vast majority of them coming before the tariffs went into place. 85% of the jobs that we've got during the Trump administration have come before the tariffs came into place. The surplus is in services where we haven't put any tariffs on it. Look, I think, you know, I'm not a tariff fan. I will say, when you're judging a tariff regime, what you need to do is judge it over a longer period of time than 1 year. I don't think it's fair to just judge it based on this. But early indications, I would argue, are not looking that strong. Okay, so here's what happened. You ever get tempted to do something kind of bad at a restaurant because you're like, I guess if I put something in my food and then I say, hey, look at this thing in my food, then I can get it for free. Now, I would hope you're not the type of person who would do such a thing, but those people do exist, believe it or not, especially, I guess, at really, really fancy restaurants where your meal may come up to like $600. Now, one gentleman decided to go and attempt this, and he decided to put a hair in his food and then say, hey, I need a free meal. I got a hair in my food. Now, one interesting thing he failed to consider was the fact that it's 2026 and there are cameras in restaurants. And so when he was trying to actually, like, this is a little gross, and you're going to be happy that you're listening on podcast, if that's what's happening to you today, because I'm about to show you a video, which is not all that gross, but it is funny. It's a guy pulling out his own arm hair, underarm hair, to put into the food, and he tried to do it a bunch of times. Do we have the video? Here it is. You could see him sitting there, and he's just oddly putting his hands inside his shirt, under his armpit, over and over again, then looking at the hairs, and like making sure he's got one, and then he puts it inside of his food and then complains. He was caught red-handed, and also he's very, very gross. But the bill was like $600. Here's my advice to you. Number one, go to a restaurant, pay the bill, okay? Number two, if you're going to scam the restaurant, pull out the underarm hair before you walk in. Maybe toss it in your pocket. I don't know. I would say don't even do it, okay? That's what I would say. Another thing I would say don't even do is be one of these Democrats that's going to avoid the State of the Union. They're now planning on doing this. They're going to have a national mall rally. That's going to be exciting. Can't wait to see that. I'd much rather watch our Blaze TV coverage. It is available at StuDoesAmerica.com. The code is Stu. We'll have a pre-show as well on YouTube.